filed accordingly.
Anthony Marquis Daniels against the Commonwealth, Mr. Fehrenbach and Ms. Campbell. If you council have not signed in yet, please do so. Apparently you have. All right, Mr. Fehrenbach, we'll be glad to hear from you. Would you like to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, 3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
All right, well, you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm here for Mr. Daniels. I was court appointed to handle the trial and the case. There are two assignments of error that really need to be addressed. I believe the third goes along with the second. The first one addresses an issue regarding 19.2-54.
Let me stop you right there. As you, I'm sure, are well aware by now, the Virginia Supreme Court has decided the case of Campbell against the Commonwealth, which deals with this statute. How would you suggest we apply the Campbell case? Now, I realize your brief was submitted prior to the decision in Campbell, but how would you suggest we apply the Supreme Court's decision in Campbell to the facts of this case?
I don't think it changes that much because of the limited nature of the Supreme Court decision. What the Supreme Court decision said was that it assumed that the warrant was invalid, but because there were exigent circumstances, they said that it was still okay to perform.
So is your position then because there were no exigent circumstances here, Campbell doesn't apply at all?
I think the law is clear based on Campbell, Quintana, and Lockhart that the court may suppress the evidence based on 19.2-54 if the notice-based purpose of the statute is not met.
Well, that leads me to my next question, then, which is if the purpose of the statute is a notice to, in other words, would you agree that the whole, to the extent that there's any legislative intent in 19.2-54 at all, it's to make sure that the defendant is on specific notice as to what the magistrate relied upon in terms of probable cause to issue the warrant?
Based on the case law, I believe that's clear.
And, in fact, that's what the Supreme Court said basically in Garza. Here, the magistrate did not file the warrant in the affidavit, but a police officer did. Now, that's not his job. It's the magistrate's job, but it was done.
Correct.
So if it was done, hasn't the legislative purpose been met?
No, because the legislative purpose is not only that the defendant gets to see a copy of the affidavit, it's that the defendant can compare what is filed with the court with what the magistrate actually saw.
Is there any issue that the magistrate saw something different than what was filed?
We have no idea. The magistrate doesn't exist as far as we know, other than the testimony of the officer in court. We only have one copy. In all the other cases, there are two different copies of the affidavit. And in Lockhart, the notice-based purpose was met because although the magistrate didn't file anything for 10 months, the police officer did file it within 30 days, and at that 10-month point, it turned out that it was, in fact, the same affidavit. Here we have...
Let me stop you, counsel.
Yes.
If I understand your argument correctly in reference to the exclusion, it's because the statute has sort of a remedy in it. And if that remedy is for 30 days, wouldn't Lockhart seem to cut against that because it was filed 10 months later? Notice part aside, just in terms of the specific time frame and the timing.
If I were arguing Lockhart, I would certainly argue that. I think I'm bound by what that case says, which is that the 10 months is okay. I reconcile that with my argument here because it turned out at the 10-month period that the notice was correct, that there was, in fact, the correct affidavit in the court at that time.
But I guess the question, let me follow up, is that if, in fact, the remedy that's within the statute has a specific time frame, doesn't Lockhart seem to indicate that that in and of itself violating that does not result in exclusion?
In the prism of
of the statute.
Right, but in the prism of the statute being the purpose of notice, I would say that in Lockhart, let's say the police officer didn't file it within 30 days.
I'm not arguing or asking you about the notice part. I think Judge Humphreys has done a wonderful job of doing that. I'm asking you a separate question, which is in reference to the remedy part of the statute. And I'm wondering if Lockhart undercuts your argument about the remedy. Because the remedy, from your position, would be exclusion of the evidence, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So if the statute says specifically within the 30-day time period, if it's not filed, then it's the remedy of exclusion. Let's just accept that as a premise. What do we do with Lockhart where there's a 10-month gap?
Well, I would say that it's... As has been pointed out, it's not a remedy of automatic exclusion. It's a remedy of permissive exclusion. And it was permissible to not exclude it in Lockhart because it turned out to be the same affidavit that was, in fact, filed within 30 days.
Well, then what will we do with the good faith exception argument?
I don't believe the good faith exception applies, first of all, because that's presuming the constitutional analysis, and I think that assumes that it's the same argument that we're making regarding Fourth Amendment exclusionary principles, and that's not the argument that I'm making here. It's based on the statute.
But Campbell implicates that the Fourth Amendment can and does apply, and if we're bound by Campbell, circling back to Judge Humphrey's question, where does that put your argument?
In terms of good faith? Well, in terms of good faith, first of all, it wouldn't make any sense if the good faith exception could apply to this abridgment of the statute, because in that case, every circumstance in which this came about would invoke the good faith exception.
It becomes a slippery slope, is what you're saying.
It would be all of them, because the idea is that there is a search warrant that seems to be valid on its face. It turns out later to be invalid.
Well, it's certainly constitutionally valid. I mean, there's no issue. It seems to me there's no issue here about the compliance with the Fourth Amendment with respect to the search warrant.
Yes.
The only issue is, was the statute violated? And if so, what's the remedy for the statutory violation? Now, the search of the vehicle is a different proposition, which
right.
I know you're going to get to, but I mean, I just want to make sure we're setting that aside. So to the extent that we're dealing with the search warrant, it seems to me there's no issue that we need to even consider with respect to any Fourth Amendment implications here, is there?
I agree. I believe it rests on the statute, and it's clear that that is a permissible remedy to exclude it, and if ever there were a situation where it should be excluded, it should be certainly where it's never filed at all. I haven't found any cases where that's the case.
Well, I think you haven't argued it, but it would seem logical to me that it wouldn't make any sense to say that, you know, if you can't use the evidence if you don't file it within 30 days, but you can if you wait 31 days.
Correct.
Anything else on that point?
On the other issue, Your Honors.
Well, let me cut to the chase on that, because I have a couple of questions about that. Maybe just cut to the bottom line there. Clearly, the warrant did not cover the vehicle. So to the extent that there was a search of the vehicle, it would have been outside the scope of the warrant. I don't think there's any question about that.
Right.
But the Commonwealth argues, and the trial court found, that this was a plain view situation. In other words, although the warrant didn't cover the vehicle, the other police officer, I forget her name, who was standing by the vehicle, could simply look through the window and see what appeared pretty obviously to be a package that matched the description of the drugs they were searching for in plain view apparently in the door area. It's not clear to me from the record whether it was sort of in the armrest or a compartment of some sort, but in any event, it was, according to the record, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it was clearly visible from outside of the vehicle. And so if that's the case, then we don't have a Fourth Amendment situation there either, do we?
Well, my argument here, and I understand that it's a tough road to hoe and a high standard, is that the court was plainly wrong when it found that item was a contraband on its face. And I say that because you point out it was in a door handle, so not entirely visible. It was at nighttime. The court,
but apparently, according to the record, to the extent that the officer was able to view it, it completely matched the description of the items that they were searching for that were listed in the warrant. Correct?
And if the officer's testimony was the only evidence that we had, I wouldn't have much to say. The issue that I found is that the officer looked at the Commonwealth's exhibit that showed a picture of that same item after he had moved it to make it more visible and said in court on the stand, yes, that has red on it. That has the red that is resembling the miracle stamp that is indicative of this heroin distribution. That exhibit is included in the joint appendix on page 136, I believe, and there is no red on that piece of that picture. And so for the court to just accept his testimony over a picture in front of it, I think is plainly wrong.
What if the officer was hypothetically, suppose the officer was just honestly mistaken and thought it had the red markings on it that they were looking for and was simply in error? Would that change the dynamic? I mean, if the officer reasonably believed that to be the case, based or simply based on their training experience, it it led to a reasonable suspicion or a probable cause that it was contraband, wouldn't that be enough?
Well, it would have to be probable cause, and I think just if there, I don't believe that would be a reasonable mistake to make, to see something that was much harder to see at the time that he initially saw it, and then in a picture when it's much more visible, to claim that there's something that there clearly is not.
All right. Anything else?
Yeah.
All right. Well, you have a little over 5 minutes left. Ms. Campbell? And Ms. Campbell, I know you're not related to the appellant in that case, but does Campbell versus Commonwealth apply to this situation as well?
I think it does apply to the situation. Obviously, Campbell, the Supreme Court, specifically chose in that case to rule on exigent circumstances. And
well, there aren't any exigent circumstances here, are they?
Certainly, Your Honor. And they mentioned how they declined to rule on a couple of the Commonwealth's other arguments that they put forward, specifically whether or not 19.254 does actually mandate that it's invalid. They just assumed that it would for their purposes.
They assumed it was invalid.
And they also declined to reach our alternative argument about whether or not the good faith would apply. But they do have language when they talk about that, that I think it's still up in the air, and I think it's still a valid argument for the Commonwealth to assert in this case.
I guess my question should be, given Campbell, what's the Commonwealth relying on to support the search in this case?
Well, Your Honor, the Commonwealth is relying both on the statutory interpretation of the statute itself, that it does not have a mandate of suppression, and I think that the defendant has admitted that today, that it is actually just a permissible.
Well, what is the mandate then? I mean, what's the purpose of the statute when it says that the evidence is not admissible I'll concede the statute's not very well drafted, but it seems to me, and I don't have it in front of me, so forgive me if my memory isn't the best, but it seems to me what the statute effectively says is the judicial officer is supposed to file the warrant and the affidavit with the clerk of the circuit court within, I believe it's 10 days of the issuance of the warrant. And then if that is not done within that period of time, it's not admissible until a reasonable time after it's filed. The evidence is not admissible until a reasonable time after it's filed unless the failure to file continues past 30 days. Do you agree with me as to what the statute says so far?
I think that is an interpretation of it.
If that's the case, then why would the General Assembly say you can't introduce the evidence until you file it, you know, within a reasonable amount of time after you file it from zero up to 30 days, but you can do whatever you want to after 30 days? How does that make any sense at all?
Well, first, I think that the statute does say the shall that we're talking about is shall not invalidate any search made under this warrant unless such failure shall continue for a period of 30 days.
Yeah,
but the statute doesn't say the inverse.
But what does unless mean, if otherwise? We have to give meaning to every word the General Assembly uses. Presumably they meant whatever they said. So if they said you can't use it, you know, unless, then, you know, it seems to me you have to meet the unless or you can't use it, don't you?
The purpose of the statute, as the court has already discussed this morning, is that it's a notice requirement, so the defendant can challenge.
Well, that's a different question, whether it's substantially complied with here by the police officer filing it instead of the magistrate. That's not the question I'm really asking here. It's a question I was going to get to, but I guess my question is, if this statute applies at all, why wouldn't there be an exclusionary remedy if it's been violated?
I think there's a difference between there being a mandatory exclusionary remedy and the proposition that you cannot use it if the defendant has not been able to review it.
Circling back to Campbell by implication indicates that the code section doesn't obviate or get rid of Fourth Amendment concerns.
Yes, Your Honor.
But here, it's a case where the only way that the apartment was searched was solely by the search warrant, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I understand Lockhart for the proposition that the filing of 10 months late did not necessarily give the exclusion. But if the purpose is for notice, what do we do here when nothing is filed? I mean, doesn't that take it out of Campbell, and doesn't that potentially take it out of Lockhart?
I do think this case is a little different because it is the only case that I have not seen a case where it was not filed at all, as in this case, except for what the officer had and the officer's live testimony. The Commonwealth's position would be that when you combine the officer's live testimony, gave the defendant the ability to challenge the affidavit and challenge the information in it,
How? Because if, in fact, the purpose of the statute is for comparison purposes of the search warrant that's executed as well as the search warrant that is authorized, how is it a comparison if essentially the same source is the officer? It's his copy. It's his testimony.
Certainly, Your Honor. And the officer testified under oath that it was his copy. It was the exact copy that he had given to the magistrate, that he witnessed the magistrate and return it to him. The trial court was able to listen to that testimony and find it credible. And in this particular circumstance, when we have the set of facts that we have where the officer was able to do that and the trial court was able to weigh it, and the trial court found that it was incredibly unlikely, I can't remember his exact words off the top, found it was complete conjecture to conclude that the officer would have filed a different affidavit than the one that he had in court that day.
And what does that do to the notice part, though? I mean, if the purpose of it is for the comparison, I mean, I understand what you're indicating about the reliability part, but what about the comparison part? There's no ability for the appellant to compare what the magistrate would have filled out and done versus what is filed afterwards.
I understand the court's question, and again, I would just say that in this particular case, I don't think there was ever been any challenge to that probable cause determination, and based on the officer's testimony and the trial court's findings of his testimony, I think that it's settled what was in that affidavit and that it was and the same affidavit that the magistrate relied on. I think that, like the trial court said, it would just simply be conjecture to assume that there was another one in this case.
Well, in terms of your good faith argument, I'm at a loss to understand, frankly, how that would apply, given that we have good faith, of course, is a constitutional concept that determines whether the exclusionary rule applies or not. We don't have an exclusionary rule situation here other than maybe through the statute. So it's the failure of the magistrate, not the failure of the... So a question, I guess, is whose good faith would we be talking about? And there's no suggestion of anything but good faith on the part of the officers who got a very valid, constitutionally valid search warrant, doing exactly what they were supposed to do and executed it, by all accounts, in a perfectly appropriate way.
Yes,
so there's not a question of good faith on their part. To the extent there's any good faith here, I guess it would maybe be the magistrate who didn't do his or her job at all, apparently. I'm not sure how that constitutes good faith when they do absolutely nothing. There's not a question of them filing later, or in the case of Campbell where they attempted to file it, but a fax machine malfunctioned and it never got to circuit court, or at least not all of it ever got to circuit court. So, I mean, I just don't see how good faith is implicated here at all as sort of a defense. Otherwise, the statute would be a nullity. I mean, it would just be a sort of an advisory statute. You know, it's a good idea if we file the affidavit because, you know, the defendant should be on notice as to what the probable cause is. But if you don't, hey, who cares? You know, that clearly can't be the intent of the General Assembly here.
Well, again, I think that just goes to what the purpose of the statute actually is, and it's a notice statute. It's not meant to be a mandatory exclusion statute.
Well, certainly it's not a penal statute that requires strict construction against the Commonwealth. It's totally a procedural statute, in my view, at least. But the point is, we're supposed to give meaning to the General Assembly's stated intent here. And to do that, we have to look at the words they use and apply them to the extent that their meaning is readily understood.
Certainly, Your Honor. And unfortunately, to the extent this court finds that the wording is confusing, that does not... the court cannot then imply that there's a mandatory exclusion remedy
certainly a draconian sanction to, in effect, punish the Commonwealth for the failure of a magistrate to do their job.
Certainly,
so we're punishing the executive branch for the failure of a member of the judicial branch.
Certainly.
But unfortunately, that's what the General Assembly apparently said is okay. And we have to, whether we like it or not, or whether we think it's fair or not, that's what the statute says.
I would disagree with Your Honor. I think that other statutes, as I pointed out in my brief, I believe it's the intercepting communications statute, that in 19.268H, the General Assembly there did obviously know how to draft a statute that had a very particular exclusion remedy. And I think that the General Assembly didn't do that here, because the issue here is notice and making sure the defendant has notice.
So is everything after the word shall file, you know, within 10 days, a nullity in the statute? Do we not give any effect to it at all? Is it just surplusage, in other words?
I think it does not mandate exclusion, and I think that's the very particular issue in front of this court.
So what does a circuit court supposed to do when the affidavit is never filed?
I think what it did here, in that it had the officer was able to testify about what he did procedurally.
The officer actually filed the affidavit. What if it had never been filed by anybody?
I think that if the defendant had never been able to challenge that affidavit in that way or have testimony or see it, yes, Your Honor, that would be a different case.
What this case then turns on is the fact that the police officer did the magistrate's job for him. Is that it?
I think that's part of it, and I also think that it is the live testimony and the defendant's ability to cross-examine what was on that affidavit.
Well, certainly, if a police officer is filing altered affidavits, exposing themselves to perjury charges and some other sanctions.
Certainly, Your Honor. And the defendant does point out on brief that it could be encouraging, or the purpose of this exclusion would be to deter bad police conduct, such as lying on the stand. But I think that is purely hypothetical police conduct and not at all present in this case. And also, the trial court did find that the police officer was credible and listened to his testimony. I just think that's...
Did you want to address the plain view issue at all?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Turning to the second assignment of error, I think it is very clear that, based on the officer's testimony, that the wax paper bags with a red stamp on them were in plain view looking into the automobile. The officers were lawfully in the apartment parking lot when they observed this in the automobile. When you take in the totality of the circumstances, the officers had been surveilling the defendant, had seen him in the passenger side of this vehicle, had information from a source that the defendant was dealing these drugs they were looking for in these wax papers with the red stamp with the word miracle on them. When you take all the officers' training, experience, and their direct knowledge of the defendant and surveillance of him, it is clear when they saw that, it was immediately apparent that that was contraband, that they could search it, and that they had probable cause to do so. If the court has no further questions on that issue.
I just have one other question. This was a conditional guilty plea case. Hypothetically, if we were to conclude that as to the first assignment of error, the defendant's argument has merit, in other words, the trial court erred in not suppressing the evidence. The only evidence that is involved there, if I understand the record correctly, is a set of digital scales, some residue, and some currency, I believe. The bulk of the drugs were actually found in the search of the vehicle.
The heroin.
So given that this was a conditional guilty plea, even if we found on the first issue in favor of the defendant, will we need to disturb the conviction at all?
The Commonwealth's position would be that you would not need to disturb the charge related to the heroin drugs.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Campbell.
And obviously the third assignment of error relative to the defendant's voluntary statements after finding the heroin, because the police lawfully searched the vehicle and obtained the heroin, then there was no Fourth Amendment violation there. And if the court has no further questions, the Commonwealth would ask that you affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. All right, counsel, you've got a little over 5 minutes left.
Thank you.
Can you maybe answer the same question I just asked Ms. Campbell with respect to the conditional guilty plea situation, or where that would leave us if we were to actually agree with you as to your first assignment of error but disagree with you as to your second?
I think she's correct, Your Honor. You do not need to disturb that.
All right.
May it please the court, I'd like just to address quickly the allegation or claim that the officer's testimony cures the problem with the warrant or the affidavit. I'd say that there's a strong public policy justification for ensuring that those two branches of government are separate, and it's important that the citizens can be satisfied that the magistrates do their job and the police do their job. For the police officer to come in, and I'm in no way imputing this specific officer or officers in general, but to come in and say, yes, I did this, and yes, the magistrate gave it to me, would not encourage a lot of faith in the system. And just to highlight that, on cross-examination, the officer did find items that he was incorrect about the affidavit. He said that there wouldn't have been any handwritten marks, that he would have gone back upstairs and put in a computer-generated mark if there were any changes that needed to be made. But then he conceded just a moment later that...
So your emphasis, though, is on which officer of the court did the filing, if you will, or talked about the requirements under statute. If the emphasis is just on the actual giving of notice, then wouldn't anything that cured the failure on the issue of notice, if you could conclude that the defendant had enough notice to challenge or not challenge as he, she wished, the result, I guess, in this case would be the same if you emphasized the giving of notice that was adequate, which, of course, would be fact-specific.
Right.
Your emphasis is on who filed.
Right.
But why would that be important as long as notice?
Because I think notice is a limiting phrase that we've used to make it more convenient. What we really should be talking about is being able to compare two different.
Well, I agree. I think for me that's part of notice. And if you can still compare and do, I mean, to me, there's a due process issue lurking here. When you say notice to me, I'm thinking, did the defendant have what he, she needed to defend? And to challenge. And to me, here's where, you know, I'm asking you, because your emphasis so much is that the police officer testimony couldn't be sufficient. Well, it depends. If the defendant could defend, then the notice should have been sufficient, no matter how it got before that individual, would it not? I mean, this is my view of possible way of looking at it.
I'd like to follow up on Judge Nunziata's question, because it raised something in my mind. I know you're familiar with the Supreme Court's decision in Campbell, and it seems to me one way to read Campbell is to say basically if there's another way to justify this thing, that the statute really doesn't, at least the sanction of the statute doesn't apply. And Judge Annunziata's point, I think, is that if notice was given, in this case by someone other than the magistrate, by filing the affidavit, under, you know, the analogy, I guess, that Campbell creates, it seems to me that the sanction arguably wouldn't apply. In other words, if this case were before the Supreme Court instead of us, why wouldn't they point to their own decision in Campbell and say, hey, it's close enough for government work, we're not going to apply the sanction?
Well, I would just have to reiterate that I don't think that just having one copy of it is sufficient notice. And to be able to cross-examine the police officer about something that happened months earlier is not sufficient either. As for the plain view exception.
Which one more question on the exclusionary rule. Again, looking at the statute, would that be far off the focus of what is intended if I see that as just another basis for exclusion? That it is only one basis for exclusion. All the constitutional bases would apply. But if you have an improper search or warrant, but none of the constitutional bases apply, you could rely on the statute to keep it from being admitted.
Yes.
I guess this is an error. You'd have no other bases would apply constitutionally.
Correct.
The warrant is perfectly fine. But the legislature has given the defendants another way if the statute is complied with, without cure. Given my earlier question.
Correct, and that's my primary argument,
okay,
is that the statute's,
yeah,
not been complied with. That,
but in terms of exclusion, if there are other bases for exclusion, constitutional, for example, why wouldn't that apply regardless of what happened in the statute? Nobody has erased that case law in a statutory mode, has it?
I'm not sure
we've
I follow.
That? You can still use them.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this is perhaps more restrictive than many of those. And the state is certainly able to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
I just want to add quickly about the plain view that if you do find, or if you can follow my argument and take my argument that there wasn't necessarily this red mark on there, I've briefed a number of cases that would demonstrate that I don't think this piece of wad of paper is sufficient to be plainly contrary.
All right. All right, thank you, counsel. We will come down and greet counsel, and the court will take a short recess.
All rise.